Well, I hope you're enjoying the Alden Report as much as I am. I'm having so much fun bringing you cutting-edge information and from entrepreneurs, from thought leaders, from authors all over the world. And I'm really excited to announce something. I'm speaking this September of 2018, at the Future Tech Expo in Dallas, Texas. It's actually September 14th, 15th, and 16th, and I'm speaking there. It's an amazing event. It's one of the biggest blockchain, Bitcoin, and tech expos in the world. People like Tim Draper and Randy Zuckerberg are going to be there, and you can rub elbows with some of the smartest people in this world. September 14th, 15th, and 16th. If you text BLUEVASE, again, text BLUEVASE to 555-888, you can be my VIP. I'm going to give you some discounted tickets, but you can also be my VIP. There's an opportunity as well to have dinner with me and my team, and we're going to sit down and we're going to talk about this world of cryptocurrency, of Bitcoin, of blockchain, and the future of technology. Again, text BLUEVASE to 555-888. If you want to be involved in this world, if you want to grow in this world, if you want to take advantage of the biggest opportunity of your life, then you need to be at events like the Future Tech Expo. Again, text BLUEVASE to 555-888. I'll see you there.
All right. Well, my name is Michael Alden. We are here in BLUEVASE Studios, and I start out every podcast like this, and I say I am super, super excited for my next guest. Again, if you're following me on Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, you know that I've been spending a lot of time, you know, talking about the world of cryptocurrency. And I'm really, really excited about not only just the world of cryptocurrency, but this blockchain world, a world that a lot of people would call me a noob. And I'm sure my next guest will maybe kind of also agree with what some of the people who have accused me of being, since I'm kind of new to this world. But it's an exciting world as an entrepreneur, as a business person, as someone who processes millions a year in credit card transactions, and seeing the fees and things like this, and seeing the benefits of the blockchain world. I'm excited, and it's a great time to be alive. So my next guest, he's an early adopter of Bitcoin. He's an engineer. He's been with a few different innovative companies. He's got his own company right now that's in the world of kind of security and protection of your Bitcoin and also other cryptocurrencies. I just recently saw him present at an event down in North Carolina, and I was really, really impressed with him. He's got a huge following on Twitter. He's a self-proclaimed cyberpunk, and he was I would call him, as what we would say here in Massachusetts, wicked smart. Jameson Lopp, thanks so much for being my guest.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, cool. So, for those of my I opened up and I said, look, I'm definitely a noob, and I know kind of what that means. But at the same time, I do see it. Tell us about your background. Cryptocurrency. How did you get involved in crypto? Have you always been, on the behind the scenes kind of development side? Tell us a little bit about your history.
Yeah, I graduated from UNC Chapel Hill with a computer science degree and spent the first 8 years of my career working for an email marketing company, basically doing back-end data analysis. When you have 100 million emails a day going out of a system, you're getting a lot of interesting data coming back in that needs to be ingested. And so I was just doing large-scale, multi-petabyte, highly parallelized cloud computing. I was actually one of the first people in the quote-unquote cloud computing scene. So it was very interesting. I see a lot of parallels being early to that, to what I'm seeing today with cryptocurrency and crypto assets and blockchain technology and all of that. And I was never particularly passionate about marketing or email marketing. It just happened to provide some interesting computer science problems to keep me busy. And then when I heard about Bitcoin and started looking into it, I got sucked into it pretty quickly. And after a couple of years and doing some side projects in it, I realized that I had the opportunity to just do it full time. And so I've been full time for about 3.5 years now.
So what year was that when you discovered Bitcoin and started to really just dive into it?
I I stopped dismissing Bitcoin in 2012. I'm sure I had heard about it before then, but you know, that's when I started actually like reading the white paper, looking at the source code, and learning more about like why the system was actually more robust than I had originally anticipated.
Yeah, it's interesting too. So you know, I've read, you know, Satoshi's white paper is what, it's only 8 pages long, right? So is that right? Yeah, because I read it. So
yeah.
You know, you look at some of these other white papers, and they're like 60 pages long. Is the genius in blockchain also the simplicity at the same time? I mean, you know, it seems so esoteric to guys like me that aren't tech guys and somewhat confusing. But is the genius really in the simplicity of it?
I would say it's pretty complicated, and it's the genius is just that all of the various complications tend to balance out, and that the game theory behind the system that Satoshi cobbled together ended up working. And like one thing that I tend to say a lot is that Satoshi didn't actually create any fundamental new technologies. Like what they did is they combined a bunch of technologies in a way that had never been done before, and it just happened to create a system that was self-sustaining and quite robust against attack.
And is it fair to say that, you know, I know that there were some attempts, obviously, you know, prior to late 2008, 2009, to get into this world of digital currency and things like this. I think it was even in the late 80s, early 90s where it started to really develop. But is it safe to say that it really kind of took hold as a result of the world economy crashing? Is that your take on it, or
it just happened to be extremely fortuitous timing. According to a few things that Satoshi said, they said that they started working on it earnestly in 2007. So I'm assuming they just got to a point where they happened to have the idea fully fleshed out, and it was, you know, ready to go shortly after the financial crash of 2008. Like that's when they put the white paper out there, and then within I think 6 months or so, the system was actually ready to go. Like the code existed and the first blocks were created.
So you're referring to Satoshi as they, right? So this mysterious character or group, do you know something that we don't know? Is Satoshi an actual group?
I try to use non-gender specific pronouns because it could be a man, it could be a woman, or it could be a group, or I mean, it could be an artificial intelligence from the future for all we know.
Isn't that kind of crazy? So this whole, right? I mean, this whole world is created in I'm an attorney by trade, and I'm you know, taught to kind of think worst case scenario. And so I think about, you know, what if this whole thing is like a big ruse to somehow just bring the world to its knees? Has anyone thought? I mean, I'm sure they have, but isn't that scary in a way, or is it so far beyond what Bitcoin was now what it was then to something that is just really, you know, obviously of use now? I mean, do people think about that?
Certainly. I mean, at this point, I think worst case scenario is that it could be a ruse to bring, you know, banks and nation states to their knees. But I don't think that it's a ruse to try to move the entire world economy onto a system that has a fundamental flaw or exploit behind it. You know, there are some theories that, you know, maybe this group of people was actually a bunch of NSA contractors and they somehow know something about all the underlying cryptography that nobody else knows. But it's just highly unlikely that that's the case. And even if it were, I think the ramifications would be a lot greater than just Bitcoin failing.
Right. Yeah. No, I guess that makes sense. And so I love that your background started out in marketing. I'm a marketer, obviously. Actually, I don't do much in the digital space. We still are still kind of dinosaurs the way we market. So, you know, the marketing aspect of this world of cryptocurrency, you know, kind of how I got involved was because of my background in credit card processing and how we – in the things we sell. And we started to notice just, you know, really how we were being taken advantage of. And I've had millions of dollars literally grabbed from us. And so I started looking at this world of crypto and saying, wow, it provides solutions. But, you know, I feel like – there is a huge need for legitimate outreach into the world of crypto? Because you get it and understand. I mean, you get it more so than anybody. Because all the way down to the source code itself. Whereas guys like me, like I see the big picture. But do you feel like? And I mean, I kind of feel like there's a big disconnect, right, between the average person, you know, Mary Smith and you know, Raleigh, North Carolina, right? And me and you. Do you feel like it's the gap is being bridged, or is it still difficult for people to grasp?
Oh, it's still quite difficult. And, you know, I would say that I mean, I get a lot of aspects of it, but I had an article that I wrote a year or two ago about why nobody understands Bitcoin, and that was more philosophical and also looking at the sociological aspects of the system and the governance or lack of governance. And that's one of the things that we're still trying to figure out. You know, we're kind of wandering around blind testing the system from those aspects. But I mean, I think this is going to be like any other type of technology. You know, you can make a lot of parallels to the internet itself, and almost nobody who uses the internet today actually knows how it works. It's just we've built so many layers of abstraction on top of the fundamental internet technology that it's easy to use. And so that's, I expect, you know, if Bitcoin really gets to mainstream global adoption, that's the only path. If we have to explain the system to people, it's just not gonna get adopted.
Yeah, you know, I guess that makes sense. You know, I think of it too. Same thing, like the beginnings of using this piece of plastic, you know, to transact. You know, I remember the early days of a debit card. My mom, you know, using that or a credit card, and you know, it was just foreign to people, and there was resistance, right? But now here we are, essentially, you know, call it 30 years later. And now it's, you know, pretty much common practice. In fact, when I was in North Carolina, I went across the street to Be Good, right? And I tried to pay in cash, and she looked at me like I was crazy. Like it threw her off. She didn't know what to do. It was really kind of wild. I was like, here I am at a cryptocurrency blockchain conference, and I tried to pay in cash, and she was confused. Folks, we are on with Jameson Lopp. He's an early adopter of Bitcoin. He's been with a lot of different companies. He's really at the forefront of this stuff, and you know, is a great, great following, a lot of great information. He's also the co-founder of a company called Casa, which we're going to get into, that really focuses on the security, which is a big deal, obviously, in this world. I mean, recently, even as of this morning, I think it was BitThumb admitted that they just had 30 million stolen. And so we hear a lot about hacking, which I think creates a lot of fear. So we're going to talk about what his company does in a minute. But if you'd like some more information about Jameson, you could just go right to his website. It's lopp.net. And you can also find him on Twitter. He's got a lot of great information there. It's at LOPP on Twitter. So, you know, Bitcoin it was the first. We all know that, right? Well, at least, you know, for all intents and purposes, it was the first big one that people know about. And, you know, you talk about and you post stuff about, you know, some of the things you can, you know, you have the source code. You're looking at it. You're seeing the transactions, things like this. What's going on with Bitcoin in particular that's going to hopefully continue to keep it as, you know, the top, and or is it really going to be what people just say? It's just going to be a store of wealth. I mean, is it going to be able to rival some of these other cryptos out there that are trying to be used for everyday transactions?
I believe so, and we've got groups of engineers that have spent the past 3 years working on these second layer technologies, and I think the second layer is only the beginning. Eventually, we're going to see third, maybe even fourth layers. This actually goes back to the internet itself, where if you look at the way the internet was designed, it actually has seven distinct layers to it from a technological standpoint, and those layers are actually what allows this decentralized, permissionless network to scale and be able to accommodate everything that we're doing, including right now streaming audio around. So if you actually look at the way that Bitcoin itself works, it's actually very similar to the lowest layer of the internet, the Ethernet layer, which is this global broadcast data mechanism. And if you tried to scale out the internet by just using that layer, it just wouldn't work because you would have to be streaming everybody else's audio and video simultaneously with your own, and the hardware just wouldn't be able to handle it. So we're building these layers on top, which do things like route the data specifically through the fewest number of nodes on the network, so that you're then able to utilize the hardware and bandwidth of the network in a more efficient way. And you know, there are a lot of people that push back on this because they say that it adds complexity or centralization or whatnot. And it certainly does add complexity. So then the next thing that is required is to add user-friendly layers of abstraction on top of the apps so that people can interface with all of these complex things under the hood and not actually know what they're doing. So kind of like what I was saying before, you know, people that are generally using Facebook, they don't know anything about all of the complex routing protocols and stuff that's going on under the hood. They're just tapping buttons on a screen and the rest is just digital magic. And so that's really what we're trying to do with Bitcoin.
Boy, that was a great explanation, man. I was like, wow, I'm so glad you said that. So, all right, so so where are we then right now when you, with Bitcoin? Are we at the Ethernet stage with Bitcoin?
We're building the TCP IP layers right now.
I actually kind of know that. I was a hardware software recruiter back in the day, so I used to hear that a lot.
But, you know, I've been working in the space for a while, but despite all of the really cool cutting edge stuff that's going on, I'm not actually working on any of that. I am still focused on very low level, simple private key management. And that's because I think this is a problem that has yet to be fully solved and made user-friendly. And that's just another one of the aspects of the system that needs to have extra layers of abstraction built on top of it if we want the average person to be able to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great, you know, great segue into what you're doing with Casa. You know, it's so in just in the world in general, right? Human nature, fear is not a bad thing, right? It's a natural instinct, and so. But the challenge with fear, right, is it paralyzes us a lot of times, and so because of people's fear, they're unable to move forward or even see something that is revolutionary. Just like me and a lot of other people, I was introduced to it in 2014. I didn't understand it there, and I was kind of fearful of it, so therefore I didn't get involved in it. And probably lost out on some great opportunities. But here I am now, and so I think the security part is a big deal. And so we hear, and also negativity, right, in this world, right? So we hear it's great to talk about, people love talking about the negativity. I never watch the news for that reason, right? But you're always hearing about, I think it was CoinRail we heard of, and then BitThumb just came out and said, yeah, we were hacked for $30 million. You hear that stuff all the time. So security is a big deal, right? Like what you are working on right now at Casa is awesome. It is kind of still difficult to understand, right? I mean, the security side of it, because like if I have a Coinbase wallet and I'm depositing stuff, I feel like I feel kind of protected, but in all reality, I'm really not, right?
Yeah, I mean, security is a lot like any of these other things. It's a very, very complex topic, and you can dedicate your entire life to understanding it. And I've been focused on security for over 3 years, and there are just so many different pitfalls and, you know, mistakes you can make just out of ignorance that can be catastrophic in a system like this because there's no one who can hold your hand and fix problems for you that as a result, I think a lot of people end up just moving their money into a trusted third party because they figure, well, this is a custodian. They're basically like a bank, and they have people who are thinking about security 24/7. Therefore, it's less likely that they will screw up than I would screw up if I was handling my own security. And so I'm seeing this trend towards custodianship. And the downside to that from a high-level view is that that's just introducing systemic risk. And, I mean, that's why Bitcoin was created, was because of the systemic risk that occurs when you have a small number of authorities that control the system. The incentives are out of whack, and eventually they're going to screw up and do things that harm all of the users of the system. So I'm trying to push the needle back in the other direction, and my main goal is to improve the user experience and basically allow users to be their own bank without having to think about all of the ramifications of being your own bank.
So tell us a little bit about what you're doing with CASA and how it works, and also how people can, you know, get some information about it.
Sure. So within this crypto asset space, it's the keys to the kingdom are your private cryptographic keys, and so you have to safeguard them from theft, from loss, from any type of event, whether malicious or non-malicious. It could just be, you know, acts of nature that cause destruction. You have to think about every possible thing that could cause you to lose those keys, because once you do, you can't get your money back. And we are trying to leverage the security properties that you get from hardware key signing devices like Trezors and Ledgers and merge that with the usability of a mobile app. So if you're using CASA as your vaulting solution, this is really meant to be a long-term storage vault, at least the initial service we're providing, not an everyday wallet. If you're using it, then you're going to have an app on your phone that you are logged into, and it basically allows you to manage this 3 out of 5 multi-signature wallet. And unlike most other wallets out there, all of these keys are going to be on hardware devices, though you will have one key on your phone in the secure element for some special reasons. That's not as catastrophic as most single key solutions, because you have to sign a transaction with 3 of these different sets of keys in order to do a withdrawal. The idea is that we are protecting you from hackers and digital theft by keeping all but one of these sets of keys offline on special hardware devices. But then we're also protecting you from other types of theft, like physical attackers, or just loss due to natural disaster, because you're going to be geographically separating these hardware devices. You know, you might put one in a bank safety deposit box, you might put one at a trusted friend or family's house, you might put one in a hole in the ground somewhere. But the idea being that it becomes extremely difficult to acquire enough private key material to actually create a transaction and spend out of that wallet. But then we're also building in a lot of best practices into the software itself, so that you don't have to be thinking about stuff like, am I checking up on the health of my keys every now and then to make sure that I'm not subject to things like bit rot, or just making sure that the devices are still there and haven't been compromised. And so we're going to be having notifications come to you to say, you know, you need to periodically sign some sort of message to prove that you still have access to this key. And if you can't do that, we're going to have a very easy to use wizard where all you have to do is go buy another hardware device and you can just pop it in, and we'll basically do a key rotation for you so that you can bring the security of your wallet back up to that 3 out of 5 setup. So it's trying to make as user-friendly of an experience for non-technical people as possible. And we've gotten a lot of interest over the past few months. I think there's a big gap in the market here, especially because, you know, we've been through a few bubbles, and now there's a lot of people who have more wealth than they probably ever anticipated having, and they're very scared of having to actually manage that wealth themselves. And we're trying to show them that they can manage it themselves with the right tools.
Yeah, I think it's a great service that you're providing, and I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, because you do have, you know, like you said, you just described it perfectly. People who probably had no idea that they were going to come into this wealth, they're not technical. They are scared. They don't know what to do. Because when I think of, you know, cold storage over Trezor or something like that, you know, it seems like a great idea. But so many things can go wrong. What CASA seems to do is like you just said, is even if something goes wrong along the way, you're there as this service provider to be able to help prevent any sort of catastrophic failure, right? Because I was watching one podcast with you, and you know, a lot of people said this too. Like, look, there's probably a few million Bitcoin that'll never be accessed for a whole host of reasons. One of them is just because they just either lost their password or they lost their hard drive, and they're screwed, right?
Yeah, and there's plenty of stories, including, you know, the guy who tried to convince a city to allow him to dig up the landfill because he's got like $100 million in Bitcoin on a hard drive somewhere. And what I tell most people is, if you want the easiest, most user-friendly, high-security solution right now, you go buy a Trezor or a Ledger, and that's the best that you can do. It's pretty easy to set those up. But once you start digging into the security model around those, if you're using them as the default single-key solution, then you are probably having to worry about securing that like 12 or 24 word recovery seed. And that in and of itself becomes this security nightmare, where I believe the vast majority of people are not going to be able to secure that seed and keep it redundantly stored in multiple backup locations. And it really just becomes this IT problem. And this is a problem of human nature, because I've met a lot of people who have been working in this crypto asset ecosystem as long, if not longer, than I have. And they are prone to the exact same issues of laziness, of just, you know, not wanting to do your regular maintenance of checking your backups and making sure that everything is kosher. And I definitely feel the pain, because I have an annual recurring calendar event to refresh all of my cold storage stuff, and I have to spend an entire day doing that. And if it takes me an entire day, then I'm sure most people would just find it completely insane to have to go through that process, and they're just not going to bother.
Yeah, that makes sense. In a second, actually, I'd like for you to, I always say this to people, talk to me like I'm in second grade, and just tell me the differences between a public and a private key in just a second. Folks, we are on with Jameson Lopp. He is the co-founder of a company called Casa. He's been in this world for a long time. He's a software engineer, self-proclaimed cyberpunk, very, very knowledgeable, understands this stuff. He's ingrained in this world of not only crypto, but blockchain. He's got a huge following on Twitter. If you'd like some more information about Jameson, you can just go to lopp.net. You can also find him on Twitter at Lopp. And also there, from there, you can find his company, Casa, and see what they're doing. It's pretty awesome what they're doing. I haven't seen a lot of companies out there that are doing as good of a job, and especially, you know, with guys like Jameson and behind it. So, all right. Public, private key. So, if you're using a Coinbase, application, you only have a public key. You don't even have a private key. Explain to me like the differences between a public and a private, and why and how they interact, if you could.
Yeah, for a second grader, I would say a public key is like your mailbox address, and a private key is the key that actually unlocks and opens that mailbox and allows you to collect whatever has been put inside it.
Well, that's easy. Great. I understand it now. Okay. All right. But again, even like with like a Binance or, where am I? So I don't use a Trezor. What am I using a private key? I mean, I have had some cryptos sent to me before that I don't even really supported by a wallet yet. But when am I using my private key?
So if you're operating wallet software that you have actually installed on some device yourself or is a hardware device that you purchased, then that wallet software is managing the private keys. The most obvious way to know that this is the case is if, like, when you're setting up this hardware or software, it gives you a 12 or 24 word recovery phrase. That is like the root of all of your private keys that they are then derived from algorithmically. So if you are not using software that is like that, you're probably using some sort of third-party web-based custodian where they actually have the private keys on the back end, and what you actually have is a complex set of IOUs and ways to interact with this third party to ask them to please, sign transactions with the private keys that they're holding on your behalf.
Okay. You know what? That was a great explanation. That makes a lot of sense to me. So, you know, we had mentioned it earlier, hacks, and, you know, CASA is obviously providing a great solution for that. But what about, what's going on with the hacks? You know, you would kind of, like you said, guys like me would just assume that people smarter than me are paying attention to it and doing a better job. But, you know, how come we are continuing to see these hacks? And I've always talked about this a little bit, and my basic understanding is that, you know, hacks happen all the time in banks. We just don't hear about it as much.
Absolutely.
Is that, you know, yeah, can you explain that? Like, maybe the dichotomy between, you know, the actual banking system and also even the crypto world? Is it different as far as hacking? Is the crypto world actually better as far as the per instance of hacking?
I don't know about that, but the incentives are very different, because when you're talking about crypto assets, you're talking about digital bearer assets, where if you can get to those private keys and move them, then there's no one in the world who has the power to claw them back. Whereas, you know, in traditional financial networks, we have heard of things like people doing wire transfers that weren't able to get clawed back, and ACH in some cases, but also in many cases, especially the credit networks, it's very easy for them to reverse those fraudulent charges. But I think at a higher level, we're just talking about internet security. And the problem is, as soon as you put any device on the internet, you've now got a huge problem to deal with, because you basically have put a door up that you are hoping cannot be breached by anyone you don't want to, but you've also put the door in a place where it's now accessible by billions of people, and you only have to have one person who's smart enough to figure out how to pick that lock and get inside and steal all the goodies. So that's why when we talk about crypto security, we talk about hot wallets and cold wallets. And really, the best security that you can get when it comes to internet security, whether we're talking Bitcoin or crypto or just data security in general, is take it off the internet. And I mean, that's why if you look at like the way that militaries set up their system, they have completely separate networks that are generally not connected to the internet. They have their own military intranet. And that's just, you know, this air gap to basically create a moat around all of their sensitive material that stops any of these internet hackers from even being able to get to it. And so that's what we prefer to do for the ultimate secure storage in crypto. But the kind of paradox is that if you want to spend this stuff, then at some point you're going to have to connect to some device that's connected to the internet. And so that's why we see most of the high profile hacks are happening at exchanges. And that's because exchanges need to have automated hot wallets. And these wallets, you know, have their private keys on computers that are, you know, their servers that are constantly connected to the internet. And I got a lot of insight into this from working at BitGo for 3 years, because that is BitGo's bread and butter, is providing hot wallet services to companies like exchanges. And there's, you know, BitGo has a lot of really great policies and things that you can set to clamp down the security on these wallets. But at the end of the day, there were still customers that got hacked on occasion, and it was always due to a problem that the customer did in configuring their own internal setup. And so while BitGo is able to offer an awesome service that is protecting I don't even know how many billion dollars worth of assets, at the end of the day, they can't forcibly like stop someone from shooting themselves in the foot.
Yeah, and that, you know, it's a, you know, like you said, the last thing you said, I had a blockchain developer on, her name's Samantha Radakia, earlier a couple months ago, and she gave the example of, well, you know, hacking or getting hacked is a lot of it is a direct reflection of how you are handling your crypto and how you're maintaining your security. In other words, you go, it's like she gave the analogy, you go to an ATM and you know in the middle of the night in south side of Chicago or something, and you wave the money around, well, you're probably going to get robbed. You know, posting images on Instagram of your wallet and how much money you have there is really going to be a challenge. So other than, you know, what's going on with CASA, which, again, we're on with Jameson Lopp. He's one of the co-founders of a company called CASA. You can just find out what they're doing. It's pretty awesome. Just go to Jameson's site. It's llpp.net. Find them on Twitter as well. It's at LOPP, and click through there. What's right now, as we talk today, you know, I remember a few months ago, or it's been probably going on longer than that, but I got excited about, like, the Lightning Network, and then people just recently got excited about, you know, the Bitcoin Cash upgrade as far as their block sizes and transaction stuff. What's right now kind of the big thing that people should be looking forward to or paying attention to within the Bitcoin, and I guess I'll say / Bitcoin Cash ecosystem?
Yeah, I think the most development that seems to be happening now is Lightning related. I expect to see an acceleration of development on these second layer networks and proliferation of different Lightning enabled apps. Of course, there will be merchant adoption and whatnot, but what's more interesting to me when we're talking about using Bitcoin as a payment rail or transfer mechanism is actually enabling new types of interactions that are not possible with the existing system. So while you do hear a lot of people, especially Bitcoin Cash supporters, who get upset because they can't buy, you know, some small retail thing with Bitcoin because the fees can potentially be a few dollars, I think it's more groundbreaking to actually enable types of economic interaction that are like microtransactions. So that's like what we're seeing with Satoshi's Place, for example, that came out recently, or these like basically pay per use metered type of services where you don't have to, you know, prepay for a monthly service or whatever. You can actually pay per pixel or pay per megabyte of bandwidth, or, you know, pay for what you're actually using. And that becomes even more interesting when you start to combine it with stuff like Internet of Things or other internet connected devices. And I think that, you know, creating an entirely new economy between internet connected devices gets pretty exciting. And we actually see a lot of like enterprise blockchain companies that are trying to do that, especially IBM.
Yeah, I saw their ad it was on the Masters, and I was just happened to watch it, and it was for, you know, coffee that I think was shipped from Zimbabwe, and it was just, and, you know, and then the end of it was IBM blockchain. I'm like, that's awesome, you know. And for me, on my side, what I'm trying to do as a non-tech person is I am trying to reach the masses of those people, the average everyday person that should, you know, you at least look into it. I mean, making money is exciting for the average everyday person, and I'm trying to get people excited about that. But I get excited also about how it's changing the world and changing people's lives in third world countries that, you know, that or even developed countries where their currency is just shit, and now that they have a, you know, they can thrive. Before I let you go, I wanted to have your or ask you a little bit about, you know, government involvement, regulations, you know, where are we at with that? You know, it seems like at least the United States seems to be fairly open. I mean, especially, you know, I watched, you know, Christian Carlo, you know, his speech, you know, in early February in front of the Senate Finance Committee talking about, you know, hey, look, you know what, we actually need to embrace this, is in essence what he said. Where do you see government regulations? You know, you hear McAfee saying things like, well, you know, there's a reckoning coming because even those who launched ICOs outside of, you know, proper regulatory frameworks are going to get hammered, and, you know, maybe they should. But what's going on in the government? What do you see, and how do you feel about it?
I've actually been surprised that there hasn't been more of a crackdown by the SEC, but I also, on the other hand, think that it's going to get out of their control, and that, you know, people are going to start raising money and not really be touchable by various government agencies. You know, if it actually becomes a problem, I would expect that a lot of people would just, you know, go offshore and, you know, find the jurisdiction that's most amenable to them. And this actually kind of gets to like the sovereign individual thesis. I don't know if you're familiar.
I got to read that book. Was it you? I think it was you who talked about it, right? You and your partner?
Probably. Yeah.
You know, I wrote that down. Actually, I definitely want to read that. Yeah, keep going. I'm sorry.
So, the other thing is, you know, ever in the early days when I was in Bitcoin, there were a lot of trolls who were saying, oh, the government will never allow this to survive. They're going to shut you down, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they had a, you know, potential point at the time, but we've gone so far now that I actually believe that at least within the United States and possibly within many other major governments, that there's actually a lot of holders who are in positions of power. And one example of that, which I believe came out recently, is like Steve Bannon actually was recently outed as being like big into Bitcoin and crypto.
I saw that.
There's an interesting story behind that. It actually goes all the way back to World of Warcraft digital gold mining with him and Brock Pierce and some other folks. But I think that there are more people in positions of power that have already realized the value of this system, and they're now incentivized not to try to destroy it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess that's also too where you start to see, you know, the large institutional money, and then we could probably talk for hours again about, you know, then now it's going to potentially erode the very essence of, you know, cryptocurrency as far as centralization versus decentralization. But maybe I'll have you back on for that. But
yeah.
Before I let you go, any last thoughts for people listening, watching? You know, should they go and check out Casa? Where are we at with that? What would you leave? I guess. Let me ask you this one. What would you say to somebody who is listening now, who has maybe listened to my podcast? You know, maybe they've learned a little bit about crypto. They're not in. You know, what should they do right now?
Invest in education, because this is the Wild West, because this is a set of new systems that incentivize scammers of all types. It's very easy to get hoodwinked by marketing because you don't have the ability or time to look at all the technical aspects of these systems that are promising the world or promising to be the next Bitcoin or even better than Bitcoin or what have you. It's not really possible to invest too much time in education and just need to have an extra abundance of caution in comparison to how you act in normal systems, because there is no there's no take backs. Like if you make a mistake, so caution and education is really my two main things. Is, you know, dip your toes in, don't just jump into the deep end, because it could end in catastrophe for you.
You know, I think that's great advice. You know, be cautious. You know, be a skeptic, but also be open-minded, and, you know, take a look at it. And if it's not for you, then it's not for you. And, but if what I, you know, what I've been trying to do, obviously, with this podcast and some of the other things I'm doing, is doing exactly what you said. Let's invest in education, learn about it, study it, and then, you know, decide whether or not, you know, you want to get it. Why I'm super excited about it, you know, a lot of you have heard my story, but, you know, I think right now, and Jameson, you know, kind of said it earlier, I think we really are at the beginning of the beginning, and the fact that we're alive and the fact that you're listening to this and the fact that you potentially could, you know, benefit from this, whether it be monetarily or even through, you know, the systems that are in place, it's just an awesome time to be alive, and I'm super excited. I didn't understand this tech world. I didn't understand Bitcoin either, but don't let that fear and skepticism hold you back from actually, you know, getting involved in at least getting that education, because that's the first step in anything. I always tell people, I've learned this before, there's two ways to really learn something. It's doing, and it's also teaching, and I'm doing a little bit of both, and I'm excited to be able to talk to guys like Jameson. Jameson, thanks so much for being my guest. Again, if you'd like some more information about Jameson Lopp, you can just go to lopp.net. He's all over Twitter as well as at LOPP. He's got a lot of other videos, a lot of other information out there. And check out his company, Casa. It's really awesome. I saw what they're doing. I saw the interface. Are you live now? Can people use it?
Yeah, so the thing about CASA is that we're starting at the top of the market and working our way down. So right now it's primarily going to be for high net worth individuals because we're charging $10,000 a year. This is for people who have so much to lose that they're willing to pay for this like level of security. But over time, we have plans to move down market and make these software applications more configurable and more accessible, and you know, hopefully have some sort of freemium product or something like that.
So, but it is available. So if someone has a bunch of crypto that they want to protect and have a higher level of education and be able to sleep at night, they can go to you and work through the CASA app.
Yeah, so we're starting to onboard people. Actually, just started this week in production, and it's like I said, it's a very boutique solution. So it's not just go to a web page and sign up. We're actually going to be working with you, and this level of service that you get is going to be 24/7 white glove service basically with dedicated support.
I love it. I think it's a great service. I think it's a great option. And eventually, if it comes down to the masses, obviously that will make sense for you. But maybe you just stay there because there are a lot of people, right, that do have a lot of crypto and don't know what to do with it. Again, so it's been an amazing show. I'm super excited to have Jameson on again. If you want some more information about Jameson, you just go to lop.net. Find him on Twitter @lop. And listen, if you've enjoyed this broadcast, if you're watching right now on YouTube, or if you're watching right now also on Instagram TV, if you're listening, if you've enjoyed this, if you feel as though that it's added value, I'd ask you to like it, rate it, share it with your friends, because this is valuable information, especially when we have top-notch guys like Jameson Lopp on. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, my name is Michael Alden, and we'll see you